From KCRW, this is Left, Right, and Center.
Fire and Fury. That has been roughly the reaction from the White House to the new book, Fire and Fury. Steve Bannon, once the president's top aide, is now Sloppy Steve. And Joshua Green, who wrote Devil's Bargain, the big Bannon book of 2017, will join us to discuss what the future holds for him. The Trump administration made a lot of policy this week. The Justice Department is revisiting Obama rules on marijuana, Interior is looking to allow a lot more offshore drilling, and the White House is, at least in theory, working toward an immigration deal. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow. Later in the show, Evelyn Farkas of the Atlantic Council will join us to discuss Trump's big nuclear button and the other big foreign policy news, our suspension of military aid to Pakistan. And California State Senator Scott Wiener will pitch his big idea to fix housing costs in cities like Los Angeles. That's all coming up on Left, Right, and Center. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow, your center and senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Anna Marie Cox, political columnist and host of the Crooked Media podcast With Friends Like These. Journalist Michael Wolff spent much of the first 200 days of the Trump presidency hanging around the West Wing conducting interviews, especially with Steve Bannon. Now Wolff's book Fire and Fury is out, saying much of the president's staff views him as lacking the mental acuity to do his job, and Trump is pissed. Trump sent Wolff's publisher a letter saying to pull the book from publication or be sued for defamation. And he's also threatening to sue Bannon over his comments in the book. Of course, this hasn't hurt Michael Wolff. The president's attacks have only fueled book sales. But Trump seems to be successfully engineering Steve Bannon's excommunication from the conservative movement. He even gave him a nickname on Thursday, Sloppy Steve. What may have the president most upset is Bannon's comments about his family. The book has Bannon calling Ivanka Trump dumb as a brick, and has him saying the path for Bob Mueller to take Donald Trump down through the Russia investigation would be a money laundering investigation, running right through Paul Manafort, Don Jr., and Jared Kushner. It's a good week for us to be joined by Joshua Green, who wrote the best-selling book Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the Storming of the Presidency. So, Josh, is Bannon dead to the president? And if so, does he matter anymore?
You know, I don't know, because in Trump's world, can you ever really say that anybody is dead? I mean, having said that, though, I mean, what Bannon has done is sort of strikes me as equivalent like the Buddhist monks that walk into a public square and light themselves on fire. It's hard to imagine how he could come back from the kind of defenestration that he got from not just from Trump, but from his main financial backer, Rebecca Mercer, who funds a lot of his operations. And according to the Washington Post, Trump has told associates, you either need to pick between him and me. And almost everybody is picking Trump, of course.
Rich, I know this has given you occasion for a little bit of a victory lap, given the way that Bannon chose to tangle with National Review right as he was going down in flames.
I don't want to bring my personal controversies into this, but I just know for a fact that Steve Bannon is a rancid liar. And I think he was an enormous media creation once he was in the White House. He seems to have done little else there except for talk to reporters all day and sit in his office with his BlackBerry and not even a computer on his desk. And this has exploded in a way that we've never seen in modern politics. You can't imagine Barack Obama telling the world that David Axelrod has lost his mind, or George W. Bush viciously kicking Karl Rove to the curb. But I think Bannon just blew an enormous opportunity. He could have been a Rove or Axelrod-like figure, a political strategist close to a president who has outsized influence on policy and is at the top of our national politics for years. And it's all fallen apart in the course of a year. And this hurts Bannon obviously much more than it hurts Trump, which is why Bannon is trying to, even though he has this honey badger act where he doesn't care what anyone says about him, is groveling and cowering and trying to crawl himself back into Trump's good graces. And maybe he'll start talking to Trump again at some point, but I don't think Bannon's ever going to be the same.
Anna, I know you've been reading the book since it came out about 3 hours before we started taping. Have you found anything that surprised you?
I think Peter Baker observed this in the Times. The most surprising thing about the book is that none of it's surprising. It all kind of plays into the narratives that we've all already felt to be true, which is in a way the danger of the Trump era. We go with what feels true rather than what is true. I will say that one of my personal favorite parts of the book so far, something that's not super important, but just weird, is apparently Trump has his own sources in the Justice Department or outside the Justice Department who are informing on Sessions. And one of these sources told Trump, the DOJ is filled with women who hate you, which if you were going to engineer, like, you know, hatred from Trump for some institution, I think that would be what you would say. But who knows what's happening? I actually really want to ask Josh, like, does any of what has unfolded in the past couple of days seem consistent to you with what you know of Bannon, like this self-immolation? Like, I'm just baffled by what motivations could be at play here.
Well, I think the motivations are clear. Narcissism and ego. You know, a lot of these interviews that Wolf conducted, the opening scene in his book, this dinner with Bannon and Roger Ailes and Michael Wolf, took place during the transition when Bannon had just engineered this incredible political upset for Trump and was kind of at the height of his powers and glorying in his reputation as, you know, the guy who was leading this political revolution. And pretty much from the get-go, I think that Bannon believed that the real revolutionary was Bannon and not Trump, and that he was just the kind of vehicle for Bannon to launch his own political movement. And so he felt, A, on the one hand, that he wanted recognition for that, and B, that he was so powerful, including with Trump, that he was essentially bulletproof. And he kind of ran off his mouth to Wolf, to me, to a lot of other people. And I think we're seeing that kind of boomerang back now that the Trump administration pretty clearly run off the rails. And, you know, he isn't bulletproof anymore, as I think Trump has ably demonstrated.
One of the things that seems striking to me here is, one, it begs the question of who's the devil in the devil's bargain of Josh's book. And I guess Trump thought he was making a deal with the devil and Bannon thought he was making a deal with the devil. And then also the question of, is Trumpism a vehicle for nationalism or is nationalism a vehicle for Trumpism? I think a lot of people have assumed that Trumpism was a vehicle for nationalism, but this drama playing out suggests that it's actually Trumpism, whatever that is, and it might be just a giant sucking void.
That's the thing, right? I mean, Trump's policy agenda, the things that he's successfully gotten implemented, have mostly been fairly standard Republican ideas. And actually, the precedent for Steve Bannon sort of recklessly running his mouth in a way that made no sense was related to the fact that Trumpism was not bearing out as a Bannon-style nationalism, which is that he got the proximate cause of him getting fired was this call that he made to Robert Kuttner, who is the editor of this left-wing publication, The American Prospect, and ranting on the record to Bob Kuttner about problems in the administration's policy toward North Korea and China, bad-mouthing his colleagues in the administration. And so, of course, that got Steve Bannon fired, and it showed his recklessness and his willingness to do this sort of thing before.
Yeah, Bannon's ideal would have been a coalition with a certain segment of the Democratic Party and the left on issues like related to globalization and trade. And that just wasn't in the offing. And for a lot of reasons. One, Bannon never had the wherewithal to pull it off himself. It wasn't clear that Trump was really fully on board of that, although he hates trade and bangs on about it. And the correlation of forces among Republicans in Washington just wasn't supportive of it because no one in Congress who's important is on board that agenda. So you end up with Bannon just sitting alone in his office calling this left-wing guy out of the blue on his own power for no real purpose. So it's a sign that the Bannon vision of the Trump presidency didn't come to fruition and probably was never in the offing.
Yeah. What's interesting to me, though, is that is the relationship between the two men. You know, each of them thought he was using the other one. And to get to Anna's question, I mean, Devil's Bargain, it was really a kind of choose your own adventure title. You know, either one of them could be considered the devil, but the bargain they struck essentially was that Bannon thought he had this politics, these set of ideas that if he found the right vehicle, could get somebody elected president. But then the bargain was in turn, the president would enact those policies. And that never happened in part because I don't think Trump really had any loyalty to the ideas he ran on. He abandoned them pretty quickly once he became president. But also because Bannon doesn't have the kind of mental and political wherewithal to carry through on the things that he talks about. And so almost from the get-go, you saw things fly off the rails in the Trump administration. While Bannon was chief strategist, essentially took up Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell's agenda, which was, let's repeal Obamacare, let's pass big tax cuts, big corporate tax cuts and tax cuts for the wealthy. And, you know, Bannon, had he really believed in the things that he talks about, would have stood up and said, you know, no, this isn't what Trump ran and won on. You know, we're going to be a workers' party, not a manager's party. But as far as I know, there really wasn't much of that. I mean, Bannon was so busy kind of cultivating his own mythology that he didn't really focus on the policies that he was ostensibly there to enact.
So I think turning to this new book, the president wants us to believe that basically everything in the book is made up, and a lot of liberals are going to pick up the book and want to believe that everything in it is true. But Michael Wolff has a bit of a reputation as a reporter for unreliability, we might say, of, you know, going and having long conversations where he doesn't take notes and then including quotes that people say, no, I didn't actually say that. And so I think, you know, as we read this book, there's going to be a need to have a little bit of a critical eye. And I want to look at one thing that a lot of people have been very focused on. One of the most damaging things that Steve Bannon said about the president, which is that he says that the path for the Mueller investigation is going to be through Manafort and Don Jr. and Jared Kushner through some sort of money laundering investigation. He says that the quote is, this Kushner shit is greasy. This allegation that Bannon is lodging here, there's some, you know, criminal conspiracy involving Jared Kushner that could bring down the president. Is there any reason to think that Steve Bannon would be in a position to know either exactly the nature of Jared Kushner's business dealings or the nature of how Bob Mueller is looking into those business dealings? Or is this just Bannon doing punditry in the way that any of us might, sort of guessing about what the situation is?
I think it's mostly the latter. I mean, he knows a little bit more than the rest of us, having been on the inside. But I think this statement about Kushner, for all we know, it might be true, but I think it's mostly born of hatred. He just hates the guy with a burning passion and was waging a war against him in the White House. And that's where these quotes came from.
Josh Green, what do you think?
I think that's basically right. I mean, it's hard to convey on the page in a book, but Bannon, when he talks, when he gets worked up, he kind of whips himself into this mania. And what you have from him is a kind of a wish casting, him asserting what he thinks is going to happen or what he wants to happen. And it can sometimes be difficult when you're reading a transcript to understand that he isn't saying this based on something he knows, but rather something that he wants to be true or he thinks is likely true. I do think he's right about that, by the way. That is assumption that this is the path Mueller is going to take is probably the correct one. I mean, one of the things that makes Bannon so interesting and quotable is that if you just look at a lot of what he says objectively, you know, he's right.
He's a decent
pundit. I was going to go on and say you know, about his comments on Jared Kushner and Ivanka, but maybe I shouldn't go in that direction.
Anna?
Oh, I was going to say, like, yeah, he's a decent pundit, but that's maybe really what he's best at. I think one of the things that this book and this ruckus illustrates is that the time period that we've been talking about Bannon is actually incredibly small. And for most of his life, Bannon has had an uneven career, I think Josh would agree. He hasn't had like the kind of soaring successes that would make you think that this is what his, you know, life's work built up to. The Trump election was a black swan event. If they had not won, we would not be talking about Bannon in the kind of law, in the kind of like, oh, dark master terms that we do. And I think that what, you know, Trump's election did, The biggest gift of Trump's election to America was to reveal all of the flaws that people had been ignoring, one of which, I guess, is Bannon's genius, and the other, which is like, you know, the various racial and class fractures in America. I also want to be sure that we do not leave this conversation without touching on the fact that one of the truths that people seem to be getting from this book and one of the things that Bannon talks about is that our president is not a functional executive. You know, that the people around him, to in Michael Wolff's term, 100% of the people around him do not think he can actually do the job that he's been elected to do, that he is mentally incapable of doing it, psychologically incapable of doing it. And that speaks to this idea that I mentioned before. If nationalism was a vehicle for Trumpism and Trumpism is a giant sucking void, like we really do have a void in that position in the White House. It can be filled by almost anyone. And I am curious who is actually running things, or if anyone is actually running things. I mean, I speculate it's Jeff Sessions because he's the only one who actually seems to have like an agenda. You know?
But Jeff Sessions isn't running things that are completely unrelated to the Justice Department.
Right.
I feel like a lot of this has just been the government operating under its own inertia.
Yeah.
And things, you know, continuing to happen when they need to happen. I don't think that there is one person behind the curtain who is making this administration happen. I think it is a large number of people picking up slack for things where normally the president would be operating. I do think it's remarkable, though, that sort of the upshot of the book is what you described there, Anna, and including that there's this one anecdote where a White House lawyer misled the president, trying to get him to believe that he did not have the legal authority to fire the FBI director because he was afraid that if the president knew that he had the option to fire the FBI director, he would do so. And it's amazing that a book like this can come out and we can look at it and accurately say, well, you know, we already knew the broad strokes of this, that this is not news because it
You're
is
just putting
it is
ornaments
such a...
on the Christmas tree. Yeah.
I guess what I meant about Jeff Sessions running things, I wanted to just clarify, is that he seems to be the only person with an actual, like in the executive branch, with an actual agenda that he's rolling out. You know, I mean, I think that Congress has its own agenda.
Sessions is recused, so he's not necessarily running entirely the Justice Department and is completely on the outs with Donald Trump. And with this book, I think that the broad picture is accurate, but it's like the old cliche about an advertising budget. I know you're wasting half of your advertising budget, but I don't know which half. I think the anecdotes and details and quotes, half of them are probably accurate. I just have no idea which half.
I will say, having talked to Bannon a lot, the Bannon quotes in the book that I've read strike me as entirely true. So I would be very surprised if those were fabricated.
Well, and Wolf claims that he has tapes of the conversations with Bannon and also with Katie Walsh, who was a top White House aide. So the quoting itself, I think, may be more bulletproof than some people in the White House would hope. Very quickly, Anna, and then we'll go to break.
I was just saying that one of Wolf's gifts is he can create quotes that sound right. That's actually one of the things he does very, very well. But I agree that probably a lot of his quotes are bulletproof.
I want to thank Joshua Green, author of Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the Storming of the Presidency. I will be back with Rich Lowry of National Review and Anna Marie Cox of With Friends Like These to talk about efforts at an immigration deal in Washington. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow. On the left is Anna Marie Cox, host of the podcast With Friends Like These, and on the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. Donald Trump met with senators at the White House on Thursday, trying to hammer out a deal that would combine new immigration restrictions the president favors with a permanent legal fix for the so-called Dreamers, that is, hundreds of thousands of unauthorized immigrants who have long lived in the U.S. and were brought here as children. Trouble is, the meeting was just with Republican senators, and any deal that gets through Congress will have to be bipartisan. There's a separate bipartisan working group that's been meeting in the Senate and includes Democrats like Michael Bennett from Colorado and Dick Durbin from Illinois, and Republicans like Cory Gardner from Colorado and Lindsey Graham from South Carolina. But none of the Republican senators who went to the White House meeting have been participating in the latest discussions among that bipartisan working group. Rich, do you have a sense of where these talks are? Because this doesn't sound to me like a process that's going to lead to a bill that the Senate can pass and the president will be willing to sign.
I kind of think there won't be a bill. But I think there very well could be a bill if Democrats just gave on one thing. You know, Trump has been talking about ending chain migration and changes to the legal immigration system. That's all really the product of restrictionists around him pulling him to that position. But what he really wants and really cares about is the wall. And the wall does not mean an actual wall across all the border. If they just gave him a couple billion dollars and said, go to town, build 25 miles worth of wall somewhere, he would give them, I think, anything they want. And if I were a Democrat rationally calculating, I think that deal is worth it every single day of the week. But the Democrats are so dug in against the wall and their base hates it for so many reasons, including the symbolism of it, I don't think they'll be able to go there. And I think we'll end up with a deadlock and nothing happening.
But so for a deal like that to come together, it wouldn't just be Trump. It would be that, you know, Republicans in the House would have to decide that that was sufficient. And I think they could be gotten there if Trump dragged them there.
Yes.
But then Trump would not only have to agree to this, not only would Democrats have to agree to this deal and Trump would have to agree to the deal, Trump would have to agree to be the face of the deal and go sell it to Republicans in Congress. Does that sound to you like something that Donald Trump would do, even as he faced attacks from people like Laura Ingraham and other restrictionists who would say, no, this deal is a sellout and you should reject it?
Well, I think yes, because he wants the wall so much. And if he sells it as this is building the wall, finally, he's going to get Republicans to come along. And a lot of his most restrictionist supporters and culture, most prominently, our friend Mickey Kaus is sort of in this place too. For them, the sum total of the restrictionist agenda is the wall, which I think is wrong. I think it should be far down the restrictionist wish list, but it's really important to a lot of people.
I don't think that quite describes Mickey's position, but we can ask him about that next time he's on the show. Anna, does this sound like a deal that Democrats should be pursuing? Should they be willing to give the president a wall of some sort as part of a Dreamer deal?
Well, first of all, I can't believe I'm hearing a fiscal conservative say, oh, just give him a couple billion dollars. What does it matter? Something just, you know, throw away a couple billion dollars on a wall. Who cares? And on something that a lot of people agree, like, wouldn't necessarily work, wouldn't do the job that it's supposed to do. I think Rich himself thinks that. I think this is a place where we're seeing that sucking void of leadership. I don't know what's going to happen. I think I agree with you, Josh, that it's unlikely that Trump can come and be the face of this. I think that because he doesn't know. I mean, on the one hand, you could take advantage of his lack of mental facility and just focus on the wall. And that would be a way to kind of trick him, which is sad. Right. But I also don't know if he even had the attention span for that. I think he is such a victim to the last person he talked to. Like, that's what this deal, you know, turns on, is whether or not the last person he talked to can convince him that the deal in front of him is good enough. That's the only way he'll be the face of something. And you know, anyone who bets on that is probably going to lose.
I think he's more committed to the wall than that. I mean, there are a lot of things. It's just the last person he talked to, but not the wall. He realizes it was a signature campaign promise of his, and he would really like to be able to say there's something that he can call a wall. And again, that's why just giving him, just build a 20-foot-high wall somewhere on the border. He will be extremely happy with that. He'll be able to take pictures of it, you know, and tweet
it
out.
Wall.
And it will, and the practical effect of it will be almost nil.
So I realize
just,
this
just
is
toss that billion of dollars away. Here you go.
Well, I mean, but this was part of previous immigration packages that yeah. were developed in the Senate. Was that one of the things that Democrats gave up was large amounts of border security spending that they thought was basically wasted. But as you know, as part of a legislative log rolling process, they were willing to spend the money because it got Republican votes
to
do.
Just to be clear, I'm not advocating this myself. I'm just saying if I were a Democrat and I wanted the DACA deal, this is what I do.
So, Rich, you started by saying that you think that there isn't going to be a bill.
Mm-hmm.
So where does that leave us? The president's six-month extension of the DACA program, which he says is illegal and he doesn't have the authority to extend, and yet he extended it anyway. He's previously opened up the idea that he could just extend it again. Do you think that's where we're headed?
I don't discount the possibility that he would do that, but I'm a little more skeptical that he would, and I tend to think just the program will expire. And Democrats probably be cynically just happy to have the issue and assume they'll be in power in 2021 and take care of the problem then.
Anna, does that sound likely to you?
Unfortunately, that sounds actually probably about right.
Okay. Well, so let's move on to some of the big foreign policy news that happened this week. The president seems to have been determined to create as much policy news as possible this week. He announced that the U.S. will suspend military aid to Pakistan, saying they're not being helpful enough in fighting terrorism. And he sent a taunting tweet about North Korean President Kim Jong-un, saying that his nuclear button is bigger than Kim's and it works. To discuss all this turmoil around the world, we're joined by Evelyn Farkas. She's a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia. Still with me are on the left, Anna Marie Cox of With Friends Like These, and Rich Lowry of National Review on the right. Evelyn, first of all, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with Pakistan. Can you describe for us first exactly what is the nature of our alliance with Pakistan? Because they've been officially an ally of the U.S. for decades, but Trump is definitely not the first president to be very frustrated by their unreliability in the fight against terrorism.
Right. Going back to the Cold War, where we have the Soviet Union pretty closely allied with India, although technically India was a non-aligned nation. The United States was then sort of to counterbalance because India's friend was not going to be Pakistan's friend, so the Soviet Union was not going to be their friend. So they turned to us, and we had a fairly close relationship with Pakistan with a couple blips along the way. And I would say that that pretty much characterizes our relationship also after the Cold War. We've needed one another, primarily in the case of Pakistan, again, going back to the 80s, to deal with the instability in the region. And then more recently, of course, the terrorist situation in Afghanistan and Pakistan. The two things are very hard to separate from one another. And so our ongoing military effort in Afghanistan, the longest war that the U.S. has fought in history, continues to rely very much on Pakistan's assistance. But Pakistan also is like a family member that's, part of the overall effort to prosper and create a good family name, but behaves badly as sort of a hedging bet. And what I mean by that is it's more important for Pakistan to have an ultimate say over what's happening in Afghanistan. And I guess fundamentally what I would say is that while there's a dependency, the United States needs Pakistan, Pakistan needs the United States, there's a lot of distrust.
So what is the effect of this move going to be? Because, I mean, obviously, I assume the hope would be that Pakistan would be more helpful for us in our fights against terror networks in the region in an effort to get their aid restored. But the risk would be just sort of pushing Pakistan away. And then obviously they have this nuclear arsenal that if the government were to become unstable and the nuclear arms were to fall into somebody else's hands, that would be very bad for everybody.
Right. I mean, I think the Pakistan's nuclear program, which has become an issue for the United States really gradually and then in an accelerated fashion, I would say from the 2000s on, that I would argue is probably more important than even fighting terrorism, only because we need to have some ability to understand what's happening with their nuclear program, and we need the assurances that their nuclear program is secure from terrorists and other groups getting access to the nuclear material and the know-how. As somebody who cares about proliferation, non-proliferation, that to me is the biggest issue. But Pakistan is key for our efforts, as I said before, in Afghanistan and in fighting terrorism globally. We don't want Afghanistan to become a failed state and a safe haven for terrorists again, although, as everybody knows, there are still terrorists operating in and out of Afghanistan and Pakistan. And so the issue is that the United States provides military assistance. So the latest issue, the thing that prompted Donald Trump to, start off the new year blasting the government of Pakistan via Twitter, was our leverage over Pakistan to try to get them to help more in the military fight and the crackdown on the terrorists who are taking sanction inside of Pakistan. And we provide military assistance. We reimburse the Pakistani government for the costs of their military efforts on the border with Afghanistan and fighting the terrorists who are also targeting Afghans and the Afghan government. And then we also provide them with a lot of military equipment through our foreign military funding programs.
So is this
and
a good
basically
move?
Trump was saying, we're not going to provide a blank check to you anymore, Pakistan, although the Pakistani government argues, well, we've been helping you all along. We know it's not a blank check.
So is this a good move? Is this going to help or hurt?
I actually think it's a mixed bag, because the part that will help is putting pressure on the Pakistanis. They need to do more. Their country continues to be a safe haven for the terrorists who are attacking our people, civilians and military, in Afghanistan. That is undeniable. And the Pakistani government could do more, and they don't. They hedge their bets by providing sanctuary to the leadership of the extremists of the Taliban who are not in Afghanistan, but actually outside of Afghanistan in Pakistan. And then the other thing they do is so they provide the sanctuary, and then they also aren't sharing intelligence with the United States, which is important. And so I think we do need to put pressure on them. I would also add that Pakistan provides logistics, means of communication and bringing material in and out of Afghanistan for the United States government. So it's also important from that perspective. And of course, their soldiers are fighting, and we reimburse them for that fighting against the Taliban in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. The thing that I have an issue with is the tenor of Donald Trump's approach. So the rhetoric, the tweeting. It's not, yes, we should put pressure on Pakistan, but the way that this administration's doing it, or at least the president's doing it, very publicly, I think, is counterproductive. And we've been down this road before. We can get into it if you like, you know, in with other administrations, with the Obama administration in particular, where things became very public and very heated rhetorically. It doesn't help either country.
Well, I think the essential insight here is correct, and it reflects the security review of the region last summer that the administration carried out. And the insight is that Pakistan is not a difficult friend of the United States. It's a devious adversary. Now, the question what you do with that insight is what's extremely difficult. I'm all in favor of banging on them on Twitter and cutting off funding, but what you need is a strategy over the long term of where you want this relationship to go and what your backstops are if it goes in the wrong direction. And that we've had a, you know, this terribly complicated relationship with them going 15, 20 years. And the problem is every time we think, oh, this time we're really going to pressure them to come along and view this conflict in Afghanistan the way we want to, the way Pakistan views the conflict goes to a fundamental national security interest of theirs that they are totally devoted to. There's nothing else they really have on their plate. That's an exaggeration, Kashmir, India, but the Afghanistan's a reflection of all that larger picture for them. Whereas we have, you know, two dozen other balls in the air. So we don't have the focus that they do. And no matter how bad they are, they can always be worse. They have nuclear weapons. So I think this will be, it's a low point in our relations that unfortunately I doubt will result in anything better.
Let's turn and look to the Korean Peninsula. The U.S. and South Korea agreed this week to reschedule joint military exercises to avoid conflicting with the Winter Olympics, which will be held in South Korea next month. And South Korea announced we'll be holding high-level talks with North Korea. Those are the de-escalation aspects of news. On the escalation front, there was Trump's tweet on Tuesday. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un just stated that the nuclear button is on his desk at all times. Will someone from his depleted and food-starved regime please inform him that I, too, have a nuclear button, but it is much bigger and more powerful than his, and my button works? So, Evelyn, what is the impact of a tweet like that? Because it feels like we've set into this pattern for months now where you'll have these rhetorical escalations, not just from North Korea, but also newly from our president. And we've had these various missile launches from the North Koreans, but no escalation yet beyond that. Is it possible that we've set into an equilibrium here of sort of like saying nasty things and doing demonstrative launches is that a stable equilibrium? Can we stay there?
Well, it may be where North Korea wants to be, at least very soon, because North Korea wants to demonstrate that it has a nuclear capability. They want to establish nuclear deterrence with us. And so if they feel that they have convinced us that they're dangerous, that they can deter us, that they can use nuclear force against us, They may settle into, I guess, some kind of equilibrium with us. And they may be then ready to actually talk about a more durable equilibrium whereby we recognize, we somehow, you know, deem their regime legitimate, although I think for the United States, we would definitely have limits on whether we would deem them legitimate. We would just accept that we would tolerate the regime, perhaps. So I think that aspect could end up being durable and stable. I do worry, though, about the loose talk because, you know, you said, what's your first reaction or something like that when you started the question? You know, my first reaction is to laugh. I think a lot of people laughed, but it's not funny. We're talking about nuclear weapons. And so I think the talking fast and loose about nuclear weapons was something I used to complain about the Russian government doing. Now my own government's doing it. And I think that makes the world a far more dangerous place. So I think we need to probably move to talks as soon as possible. We need to tone it down. And so I don't feel comfortable leaving the status quo with this kind of tit for tat or tweet for tweet commentary.
Speaking of tit for tat tweeting, it is time for Tweets of the Week. Sometimes all you need is 140 characters or maybe 280 characters to capture the spirit of the week. Rich Lowry, was there a tweet other than the big nuclear button tweet that stopped you in your tracks this week?
Yeah, this does not necessarily speak well of me, but I really enjoyed a tweet from the novelist Brad Thor that was an homage to the Miley Cyrus Wrecking Ball video, except for it's Donald Trump nude riding the wrecking ball, which is Steve Bannon's head. So I find this highly amusing, but don't look at it or look at it only knowing that you'll never be able to erase it from your eyes if you actually see it.
I'm Marie Cox. What's your tweet of the week?
It's from a Huffington Post editor, Ariel Edwards-Levy, who says the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity retires to spend more time with its unsubstantiated allegations.
Evelyn Farkas, what's your tweet of the week?
Okay, so my tweet of the week is a little bit depressing. I'm sorry. It's from Bana Alabed, who is an 8-year-old refugee girl from Syria. You guys might remember her. She made the headlines, I think, last year during the Aleppo bombings. She was right there till the very bitter end. Her mom manages her account. On the 4th of January, she posted a picture of an infant, I guess, passed away. I mean, a dead infant, but it didn't look dead in the picture. It looked injured. It had a bandage on its face. And she wrote, "They bombed and killed this baby in Pound, Syria. Sorry, dear world. It's not a happy but sad new year for Syria." And I think the reason I wanted to pick this one is because it's a reminder that while nobody's paying attention to what's happening in Syria, there are multiple little Aleppos occurring right now in Idlib and in East Ghouta. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. So, you know, there is a humanitarian crisis still in Syria, and we probably need to pay more attention to that as well.
I've been talking with Anna Marie Cox, host of the podcast With Friends Like These, and Rich Lowry of National Review. And I want to say thank you to Evelyn Farkas, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and former deputy assistant secretary of defense in the Obama administration. We'll be back with California State Senator Scott Wiener to talk about California versus Trump. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the left is Anna Marie Cox, host of the podcast With Friends Like These. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. California has officially declared itself a sanctuary state and in many ways has sought to position itself as the seat of resistance to the Trump presidency. And President Trump's administration has in various ways pushed back. Two announcements from the administration this week are likely to draw especially negative reaction in California. One was a memo from the Department of Justice withdrawing guidance from the Obama administration that directed U.S. attorneys to move away from prosecuting federal marijuana crimes where the activity against federal law is in compliance with state law. California is one of several states that have legalized recreational marijuana. And the Interior Department announced a draft proposal to open nearly the entire American coastline to offshore oil drilling. There hasn't been oil exploration off the Pacific or the Atlantic coast in decades, and California has essentially banned new offshore drilling sites since a major oil spill near Santa Barbara in 1969. To talk about California versus Trump, we're now joined by Scott Wiener, who's the state senator representing San Francisco. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So how is California going to respond to these announcements on marijuana and on oil drilling?
Well, we're used to a near daily barrage of craziness coming out of this administration and also specifically targeting California. In terms of offshore oil drilling, which, of course, is both the Atlantic coast and the Pacific coast, there's already a bipartisan pushback because Florida doesn't want this either, for example. But we're going to push back very hard. There was a bill in the California legislature this year to ban any offshore drilling off of our coast in the waters controlled by the state. I believe that bill will move forward this year, and we got to get that passed. And of course, we will do everything we can to fight the federal process through litigation and otherwise to stop the destruction of our ocean. You know, Donald Trump is obsessed with coal and oil. We want to move towards a clean energy future. And in terms of cannabis, I think for Jeff Sessions and Donald Trump, this is a house of cards. There is bipartisan support for allowing states to go their own way on cannabis. And we're already seeing bipartisan pushback. And eventually Congress will do what it did, frankly, under the previous administration, which is to pass legislation to stop this federal crackdown. The third thing that you didn't mention is the director of ICE a day or two ago said something about potentially arresting and prosecuting elected officials who support protecting immigrants via sanctuary cities or states. So I just want to make sure that if they arrest me, they give me notice so I can look good during my perp walk.
Rich, I've been honestly surprised by the administration's choice to pick these specific two fights. Marijuana legalization has just gone up so much in the polls, it even has majority support among Republicans now. And while parts of the administration's energy agenda, I think, have been popular, I don't think this one is. And you've seen a really swift negative reaction, as Senator Wiener notes, even from Republican officials like Rick Scott, the governor of Florida, who's otherwise been very close with Trump. What do you make of these two decisions?
Well, on marijuana, I disagree with Jeff Sessions on the policy, but I agree with him on the law. And the solution here should be Congress passing a law, as the senator just alluded to, saying states have the right to go their own way. But that's not the federal law at the moment. So I think the so-called, I guess, was the Cole memo in the Obama administration was just saying the federal government should ignore the federal law. And that's just never the right answer. On drilling, I think it's a welcome development. I think there'll be a lot of pushback politically, as we've seen. There'll be lots of areas that you actually don't want to drill in because it's not cost effective. But I think these are federal waters. Federal government controls them. And in general, I'm in favor when there's wealth sitting beneath our feet, we should go and exploit it. And unless there's some compelling reason otherwise. And we've had one enormous oil spill, the BP spill that cost BP something like $62 billion. So companies have a lot of incentive not to be as negligent as BP was. And that one aside, you actually have seen a diminishment in spills from these sort of offshore operations. And the research shows actually you're more likely to get spills from tankers, which is what you use when you're importing oil rather than from these offshore rigs.
Anna, what do you make of the Democratic reaction, especially on the marijuana aspect of this? Public support for marijuana legalization among Democrats is now sort of north of three quarters. I've been surprised that you're not hearing a more unified voice among Democratic office holders, not just to let states do what they want, but specifically that marijuana should be legal.
Yeah, well, Trump will turn us all into Federalists, I think. I expect it's only been a little while since this got rolled out, and I expect that the opposition will get more unified, especially since this has grown. This movement has grown, if you'll excuse the expression, far beyond the sort of normal activists that you used to see on college campuses. And there's a lot of mainstream, as you said, and a lot of conservative support for decriminalization of all sorts of drugs, really. Especially the research that's been showing that legalized marijuana looks like it may impact heroin and opioid use in states where it's legal, and there is less use of those drugs, which are actually killing people at record numbers. I do think that this is an example. I bring back Jeff Sessions. I mean, this is his life's work, is to put brown people in jail and to criminalize all kinds of drugs. One of the things I didn't mention from the Wolf book earlier that I saw in my reading is that early on in the administration, apparently, according to the Michael Wolf, Jeff Sessions decided he needed, in order to fulfill the kind of work he wanted to do, his personal agenda, that is why he would like distance himself from the Russian investigation and distance himself from the White House as much as possible, because he has these other priorities and he is putting them into play. This is what is happening. I do worry that the long-term effect of the Trump administration is going to be the kinds of things that the Justice Department is doing, much more than anything that comes from the White House itself. So I hope that there is unified opposition to both or all three of these things that we're talking about, the offshore drilling, which I think there are other reasons besides spills to not do offshore drilling, and also the ICE ramping up and marijuana criminalization.
There is a second reason that we have Scott Wiener with us today, and that's to follow up on a conversation we had on last week's show about the high cost of housing. Scott, you represent arguably the least affordable housing market in the country, San Francisco, and you're sponsoring three bills that aim to get more housing built and push costs down. One of those would have the state override local zoning, basically saying if land is within half a mile of a transit station, the city's not allowed to restrict it to single-family homes. They have to let people build apartment buildings of at least four stories and sometimes even taller. What's the idea behind this bill?
Sure. We have a terrible housing crisis in California, and this is one of those issues where, we have a lot of challenges caused by Donald Trump, but this is one of those issues that pre-existed Donald Trump, and we have to get our own house in order here in California. We, over the last 50 years, have made it progressively harder and harder to build housing in California, and to the point where in the last 7 years, the Bay Area has added one new housing unit for every 7 or 8 new jobs. And this is a statewide issue now, and it is strangling our economy. It's undermining our climate goals because people are pushed into sprawl and crushingly long commutes. And we need to get more housing, sustainable housing, dense, transit-oriented housing near public transportation so that not everyone has to drive everywhere. And that's a solution in terms of carbon emissions, in terms of congestion, and so forth. And we have a lot of transit stations, BART stations, Muni, Caltrain, LA Metro, stations where it is zoned for super low density around the station, even zoned for single family homes. And what we're saying is that's not okay anymore. We need to allow denser housing near public transportation. And, you know, nothing against single-family homes. I grew up in one. But for a city to tell an owner, no, you can only, we know it's right across the street from a BART station. You can only build a single-family home. There are no apartment buildings. That needs to end, and that's what we're trying to do.
So to take a specific example, there's a subway line under construction on the west side of Los Angeles. And if your bill were law, it would seem to require major changes to the character of existing neighborhoods in places like Beverly Hills and Westwood, also in Santa Monica, where there's a light rail line. And in your own district, lots of San Francisco would be effectively rezoned by this. You'd have areas that currently have single-family homes where you'd probably see a lot of new apartment construction. Are people ready for that? This seems like exactly the sort of thing that has drawn a ton of resistance at the local level. The reason that it's become so hard to build housing units is because people seem to cherish those neighborhoods, that character, don't want this change.
Well, you know, we all, every one of us lives in a neighborhood, myself included, and we all cherish our neighborhood and what drew us there. And I get that and I respect that. But the result of being so insistent on maintaining the look and physical feel of your neighborhood, saying we don't want change, you're actually creating a lot of change. So you're maintaining the architectural look, but then you're kicking out all the people because no one can afford to live there. And by restricting housing so intensively, what we're doing is we're causing evictions and displacement. It means that families that have that a first or a second child have to leave, often the entire region, because they can't afford housing. So we're preserving the architecture, but we're absolutely ripping apart the diversity of our community, the people. And so, yes, there, of course, will be resistance to what we're proposing. But what I will also say is, in the 7 years that I've been in elected office and in the years before that when I was a neighborhood activist, we've seen a sea change in terms of the politics around housing. And this kind of bill, 5, 6, 7 years ago, would have been absolutely impossible. It would never have moved one inch. We actually have a shot. And you know, of course, there will be give and take. But the politics have shifted because people deeply understand and see every day what the impact is of not building enough housing. And so I do believe that we'll be able to overcome the resistance. And again, there will be is always give and take. But the politics are there and people get it.
Rich, this would seem to address something that Megan McArdle was talking about last week, mm-hmm. that basically you have individual localities and they restrict development in part because they don't want new low-cost housing units to go in because then people will move into them and they'll pay right. less in taxes than they consume in services, but those people have to live somewhere. Does this sound like an appropriate approach where you basically have the state come in and say, no, you're not allowed to do that. That's a bad kind of competition between municipalities. And if you have a subway, we're going to make you allow more building?
I don't know about where this decision should be made at the state level or at the local level. I do wholeheartedly support, though, this direction. And I think Scott is absolutely right and puts it very well in terms of the outside of these communities being the same simultaneously, they're being hollowed out because not the same kind of people can live there who are there 30 or 40 years ago. And if I remember correctly, there's one of these big studies about income inequality and income mobility city by city in the United States. And one of the key indicators in terms of the cities that were most unequal and had the least income mobility is having enormously long commutes that made it hard for working class people to get to their jobs. And that's exactly what Scott is talking about. So I think more housing, more development should be the goal here.
Anna, what do you think?
I think this is a place where we're all going to agree. I think this sounds really promising. I've also read some studies about income inequality. I think that suggests that income diversity and racial diversity lead to social mobility in a neighborhood. And also, we could probably see a real change in how we think about schooling if we have neighborhoods like this. I am very interested to see how this plays out in San Francisco. I lived in San Francisco during the first dot-com boom. I thought housing was bad then. 20 years ago, one of the most indelible memories I have of San Francisco, though, is that San Franciscans, if I may be so bold as to make a generalization, tend to talk very liberally but live very conservatively. Maybe I'm just remembering a San Francisco of the years that the guest was talking about that would have rejected this kind of law, but I'm hoping that that has changed. I'm hoping that people will embrace this. I think it could be a real gift.
I want to thank California State Senator Scott Wiener for joining us. We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
A Wall Street Journal report this week contained a welcome reminder that the law of supply and demand still applies. In those cities where unemployment is lowest and the labor market is tightest, wages are actually growing robustly. It's a sign that the labor market isn't, at least not anymore, fundamentally broken. May this trend spread across the rest of the country.
Amory Cox, what's your rant?
Well, I'd like to shout out to the Washington State Attorney General, who is suing Motel 6 under the Consumer Protection Act for violating the rights of customers with Latino-sounding last names. Hotel employees were found to be turning over guest lists to ICE agents to do raids in their hotels. Over 9,000 guests were affected. It's a terrible violation of rights, and to me, it speaks of this creeping authoritarianism and creeping dystopian aspects of our society under Trump. This was done completely on the whim of the Motel 6 employees, apparently. Tom Baudet, the voice of Motel 6, apparently also denounced it.
That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Anna Marie Cox, Scott Wiener, Evelyn Farkas, and Joshua Green. Sarah Fay produced today's program with assistance from Jenny Hamill and Laura Dine Million. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Burskins and Colin Cab Washington are our production assistants. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.